Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
You're now in the Essential Zone, where we seek to be informative, inspirational, enlightening, and dynamic. But more importantly, we seek to be fair and balanced. There comes a time when the game tolerates no spectators, only players. There comes a time when we must recognize that our individual aspirations shape our collective destiny. There comes a time when getting in the game, despite the risks, despite the challenges, regardless of the cost, is simply the right thing to do. There comes a time when we must find our hearts, find our soul, and pursue our purpose for the greater good of all, for country, for humanity. There comes a time when we must manifest our true greatness. Yes, there comes a time, and that time is now. So let's get down to the essentials. The Essentials, serious radio for serious people committed to advancing the national conversation.
Welcome to a special episode of The Essentials with Hubert Edwards. Tonight, we will join Hubert as he moderates OGS Economic Roundtable with Minister of Economic Affairs, Senator Michael Arkitis, Gawen Bo, CEO of Fidelity Group, and Maladu Karen, renowned Caribbean economist. Let's get down to The Essentials.
And here's what's happening. Here's what you can do to benefit from it.
Okay, fantastic. I want to switch to you, Marla. And there was a mention of, I think by the minister, that you know an entity like the IMF would love to get us to make some adjustment earlier. But when you take into consideration this whole idea of the debt, we need a look at the debt strategy, we need to cut unproductive spending, and we need to look at taxes. You know, how do you see all of these reforms from an economic point of view, from an economist point of view? How do you see this coming together to pursuing the growth strategy, to pursuing the reforms, and to get the country to a place where we can take some of the pressure that is currently being experienced in the economy?
That's a good question. I feel like it's, you know, we have a situation now where real incomes are being eroded. Wealth is being eroded. People on fixed incomes like pensioners, they are being affected by this inflationary pressure. And just like we did at the beginning of 2020, we have a situation here that's a social crisis where people are being affected. And, you know, the Dominican Republic, for example, is subsidizing the basic food basket. There are countries that have removed or significantly reduced their duties and VAT on imported food items so that people can afford to eat. And so in terms of the sequence with which these reforms are carried out and the priorities of the various reforms and initiatives that the government will be announcing in their budget, I think it's a very critical time to make sure that we get that social element right. Of course, it's a difficult time for the government of the Bahamas to prioritize that versus fiscal restraint and fiscal prudence, which is critical to putting the whole country and the government's finances on a sustainable trajectory. So it's a very delicate balance that they're going to have to strike in this budget. And again, I don't envy the minister or anybody in government involved in a budget right now. It's a very difficult task. And I just want to say that this highlights how important it is for governments to have a counter-cyclical fiscal policy approach, meaning that when you're not in a crisis, when things are stable, you need to set some money aside because we know that there will be a crisis. And I think the last 3 years have demonstrated very clearly to us, you have in the Bahamas, you have natural resource driven crises, you have health related crises, and now you have inflation and war related crises. So it is very important that governments find a mechanism like a sovereign wealth fund, for example, to set aside a little bit all the time, every year in your budget, so that you have something accumulated when this crisis, any crisis, the next crisis hits, you have something to leverage, to insulate your society from the fallout. And most of us don't do that in this region. So again, how do you ask, how does everything come together? I think it has to start right now with social protection. Unfortunately, that's where we're at again, almost three years into this crisis.
Okay, and I think that's a great way of looking at it, because at the end, if we're going to have the ability to create buffers and to create counter-cyclical spending, then certainly we need to have growth, or at least to have discipline on the expenditure side. Gowon Bo, I am going to do something different here. I'm going to make you the Minister of Finance for this budget cycle. How would you navigate the issues of taxation in this budget, and what is it that you would foreshadow for the next 2, 3, 4 fiscal periods?
Well, certainly heavy is the head to wear the crown, so I'll leave it as being imaginary. But yes. In reality, I think, personally, if it were me sitting in the chair, maybe not a populist view, this is going to be the one where, to the first question you asked to the minister, what would be different in the budget, would be a greater analysis of our past performance to identify where the inefficiencies are, what are the issues that we are changing in order to address them, and then the sensitivity that we have to economic circumstances, meaning that we are a consumption-based tax system. I think that we have long recognized that tax reform is important, and I think it's important to now set the tone that we are going to be looking at a tax system that allows us to do three things. Be more equitable, which the minister referred to, so pay better based on a capacity to pay. Effectively have sufficient revenues to meet the government's expenditure, because we collect actually a very low percentage, and not a popular sentiment when we express it, to say that it's less than 20% of GDP. And then thirdly, to allow us to compete on the world stage. I think more specific to your question, though, in terms of, well, what will we want to see in the tax revenues? I think this is actually a cycle where the commitment to not raise taxes may not be as strong a commitment as I would make, meaning there would be absolutely no raise in taxes, but is not a time to, revamp taxes, because we are emerging from very contracted economic activity. And so people have, whether it's good or bad, a relative certainty around the tax system that currently is operated. So I actually do endorse the actions of the Ministry of Finance in terms of, let's be better disciplined at collecting what it is that is due. But I think we need to be more candid about why we have such leakages, which means it's inefficient. And we need to move to a system that is not trying to plug one hole when there are six holes across the bow. It is one of saying that we're changing the bow. And that's more, longer term in terms of the tax reform. I think that we have some opportunities on the tourism front as we look at the Airbnb, as has been mentioned, not to damage the industry, but to, as we have intimated, to slowly bring them into a tax system. And I think sometimes it's not always appreciated that you render unto Caesar what is due to Caesar. That in reality, yes, we can say that those who are entrepreneurial and creating homes and apartments, et cetera, for the Airbnb business, you don't want to kill their business. But how are you, who are extracting benefit from the economy? So you're relying on the airport infrastructure, you're relying on the port infrastructure, you're relying on the road infrastructure, you're relying on the electricity infrastructure, and selling a product. And so if you're selling a product, you have to remit your taxes. I think we need to also look at our heads of agreements with our major tourism developers and really ensure that they are honoring their commitments under the heads of agreement, meaning that there have been many commitments that have been made by government, and those very quickly get drawn upon by the large developers. But is the flip or the reverse the same? Are there commitments that have been made by them that are not being honored, where they are effectively taking a holiday or seeking to defer to help their cash situation when they're not always being as mindful to our tax situation as a country? So I think, you know, in terms of this cycle, this is one that I would like to see this budget do more of an analysis or more of a detail of the estimates and assumptions that are going into it, their sensitivity to economic changes, meaning that if these things don't play out, what is the impact of those things playing out? And look at all agreements with a view to saying that now is time that we ensure all parties are honoring their commitments. That doesn't mean solely by pursuing what we call delinquent taxpayers, because some of those are just inefficient taxes that we're going to have to revisit. But certainly looking at those that have made commitments and may not be honoring them. And that starts from our Northern Ireland that we all know about, straight down to the South that has a number of developments throughout them that we would want to say that they're honoring their obligations. Yeah.
I think that is fundamental, and I think we have heard it said in different ways that we need to look at our concession regime and make a determination what value the country is getting, because after all, it is a means of investment into the growth and the development of the country, and to the extent that is not effective, then we are actually kind of, you know, taking away from ourselves. Before I come back to the minister, you know, just being mindful of the time that Ms. Dukeran will spend with us. As you look at the Bahamas, and I know you're very familiar with the country, but you have this wider Caribbean perspective. You would have said earlier that there's some things which are done, which have been done up to now, or the plans, and these are the right things to do. To what extent is therefore the Bahamas currently, does the Bahamas currently have a policy framework that augurs well for mid to long-term growth?
That's a very good question. I think that in the first place, as I mentioned, there is clarity around what the policy goals are as it relates to debt and the deficit. I think that the government can probably articulate more widely what its policy goals are as it relates to, for example, unemployment, growth. So that's one thing, having goals and articulating how you're going to achieve those goals and what kind of time frame you're going to achieve those goals. And I think that's very powerful in gendering clarity, transparency, and accountability. And that's the second thing. What I find is missing in many budget exercises is you get a lot of talk about projects and initiatives and spending targets and revenue targets, and you don't often get in a year's time an account of this is what I said I would accomplish, and this is what, in fact, I've accomplished. And the gap, here's how I explain it. I think that that kind of transparency and accountability will augur well for confidence, for business confidence, consumer confidence, investor confidence. But it will also lend credibility to the government's efforts and where they've been able to execute on the plans and initiatives that they articulate in the budget. Those are things that I feel are very important at this stage. I mentioned the Sovereign Wealth Fund. You can call it something else, but I think it's very important to set aside money so that when there is a crisis, you have something to draw on. And I just want to give you a little example that I find quite powerful. So in Trinidad, I think we were the first country in the region to have a sovereign wealth fund. And it's usually something that countries who are resource rich will be the ones to establish, generally not countries like the Bahamas who are more tourism and service dependent. That's not generally the type of country that would establish it, but it doesn't mean that you can't. And successive governments in my country had only deposited less than just under $3 billion over a long period of time, a couple of decades, if you will, into this fund. But do you know that this fund was able to grow because the fund manager did a very good job? This fund was able to grow in total to close to $10 billion. There were drawdowns over time. So it means that it never really got a balance of $10 billion. But when you add up what was drawn down, plus the balance that we have today of just under $6 billion, you know, we were able to grow this to like to close to $10 billion. So the point I'm making to you is, even if it's small amounts, over time it grows and compounds. Gawan would be better to explain this to you than I am. And so that's also something that I think is a critical reform that I feel many small countries should consider in this region, whether or not you're natural resource based. And finally, and I think that this is something, I know the Bahamas passed legislation around having a fiscal framework. I think that's also very, very important in adhering to what your fiscal rules are around your deficit size, your debt size. But what is also important is reporting to the people, again, the transparency and accountability so that people understand what your goals are. People understand what you're doing to achieve these goals, they understand where you've fallen short, why you've fallen short, and how you're going to change or adjust your approach so that you can achieve the goal that you want to achieve. And it just engenders confidence and it engenders credibility in the government and its power to execute on its goals. All these things, I think, are important reforms. Some of which are already underway in the Bahamas.
Thank you so much. And I think you touched on some very powerful things. Certainly, the previous administration did an excellent job in improving the level of transparency and the extent to which information was shared. And this current administration has continued that, and I think in some ways have improved upon how the information is presented and the quality of the information. And so, you know, I think that evolving it is so important for the country. I want to piggyback off that to you, Minister. Despite the shifts, despite the additional information which has been put out into the public and really out into the world, we seem to have not yet mastered the conversation with investors, especially those who invest in government bonds. We see where right now the country bonds are at a very trading at a very significant discount. Why is there this disconnect between the optimism which has been seen on the ground and the conversations with the investors?
I think two things. I think during the last maybe 2 years, let's say during the COVID period, you know, where governments were preoccupied with basically staying afloat and providing services to the people, perhaps that level of communication was not what it should be. And so what we've been trying to do is have these periodic conversations with bankers, with big investors, with individuals who have liquid assets that they might want to invest. And so we've been having regular conversations, for example, with our investors, with the local banks as well, with the international banks, IMF, IDB, rating agencies, to just keep that conversation going that we are optimistic. Now, having said that, the analysts tend to be very conservative and very you know, very conservative, and it's more of a show me situation because, you know, perhaps they've heard some of this before, but we think the good thing, the idea is, and what we wanted to do as a new administration was continue that conversation and begin to start to show some results. Number one, to show that, okay, what we said we would do, we have done, and you start to see some results, for example, in as we move to open the economy. I think a part of the disconnect as well, Hubert, is that there is value to people actually coming here. And we have heard people say that when they got here and they see some of the activity that's going on, for example, the airport is busy, the hotels are full, there's construction going on, it gives a better, you know, a more concrete appreciation of when we talk about the economy growing. So I think it's a combination. You know, the conversations might not have been ongoing because the government had other priorities. And so we have to continue those conversations and we have to back that up with information showing, listen, we're getting results. And as much as we can, if we can get some more people here to actually see what's going on the ground.
Can I add to that, Hubert, though? And the reason why I say that is only because of the engagement with these parties. There are a couple of things I think will make a big difference that we are trying to develop as we move on. I use the term perspectives, but I'm going to say more of an actual presentation that we develop that shows our forward-looking prospects and is continually updated so that we are able to provide it on a regular basis. The reason why I say that is important, when you engage with the external parties, what you will hear them say is very often the financial information, even though more of it has now been presented, there is still this distrust because past information is very often restated. And there's no rhyme or reason in terms of great detail as to the restatement, that everything is, if you will, in what is deemed to be an outturn, an expectation, and then you kind of move on to the next cycle and you don't go back and say, well, you know, 2021 is closed, like nothing else is changing in it. So I think that we have to start looking at government very similar to how we look at business that is publicly traded and is engaged with investors, because it is saying that you are reporting information, though, that is deemed to be finite, reliable, trustworthy. You are putting out a prospectus document that says, this is my five-year forecast, and I am updating it as I go quarterly, semi-annually in order to do so. And I think ultimately that the engagement that the minister spoke on also is important to have persons who are on the ground as a part of that, meaning that if you speak to the entities, they will say, well, of course, government is optimistic. Right, because it has no other choice. It's trying to sell a bond. But do I have parties who are interested parties that may be also in the environment that are also a part of what I'm going to say, the roadshow team that is saying that it can bring the perspective that is saying, yes, there may be some criticism or critique of government's aspects, but it is also bringing, I'm going to say, validity and credibility to saying this optimism. So this is what you're seeing. So I think, you know, the two things, as I said, we have to get to the reliability of information to say that it's not restated, because that has a huge impact. And then we need to have a rolling prospectus document that says, these are the things that we're forecasting. These are the risks that we say are presented, and we are updating ourselves as we go along so that in reality, most of the analysts will say they are formulating their own opinions by putting numbers together. We have to get to a point where the numbers we are presenting are deemed to be fixed and finite, and then you can make a professional judgment on it.
I think that is so important. Also, I think we have to get to the place where we make the connection between optimism, investor confidence, and what translate ultimately to the government coffers. Because it's one thing to say we have new investment and great things are happening, but if the underlying economic arrangement doesn't move capacity to change the ability to pay back these loans, then obviously we will have some sort of a talent. And so we want to use that as a mean of kind of cleaning the palate, and we are going to make a quick shift to accommodate Ms. Dukeran, who will have to leave shortly. We have a couple of persons here from the press, and we are going to give them an opportunity now over the next 10 minutes or so to just direct some questions to Ms. Dukeran, and then we will just go back into the moderated session with the minister and go on, and then we'll have some more questions. So go ahead, Ms. Turnquist.
Hi, thank you so much for the opportunity. Ava Turnquist from Eyewitness News. My question is directed first and foremost to Mr. Dukeran, but then also the other panelists can chime in. I note, Mr. Dukeran, you mentioned that we are unfortunately yet again still at the social assistance stage where our focus, you can let me know if this is a good summation, but our focus is now still on social support and social assistance because we're in a social crisis. What with COVID cases yet again on the rise, and taking into consideration what you say about the fact that we really don't have much time, what would be your assessment of the current status of the Bahamian economy? Where are we now in terms of the post-COVID environment? Are we in a recovery phase? Are we still in a crisis phase? How would you assess us at this current moment?
You're muted, Marla.
Oh, sorry, Hubert. Sorry, I wasn't even sure if it was for me. Thanks for the question, Ms. Turnquist. I would say that the Bahamas is not yet out of the woods. Many countries in this region, however, are in a similar position where we're not yet at 2019 levels of economic activity, or I should say pre-crisis levels of economic activity. In the case of the Bahamas, we're thinking pre-Dorian levels of economic activity. We're absolutely not yet at that level. And so because we're seeing positive growth and we're seeing improvements in tourism and across the economy, we're seeing some positive momentum. It's positive momentum that is going to get us back at some point to where we used to be before Dorian, but we're not there yet. So I would say we're improving, but we're not yet out of the woods. That is true for most countries in this region, however. So Bahamas is not unique in that regard.
And if I could have a second question, due to that sort of shared reality, do you think that there's even more, there should be more regional...
You're a little bit low. I don't know if...
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes,
can you hear me better now? Okay, I'll try and shout. So with the fact that many countries in the region are facing this, do you think that there should be a more regional cooperation, or do you see where there's still this reliance on first world countries to help us to drive that stimulus? Are we focused to where we need to be focused in terms of regional cooperation, do you think?
I think both. I think we've always been, I think we've fantasized and we've had an obsession with regional integration, before I was born, but we've never really made significant strides in that direction. And I feel like right now, we might be on the cusp of being able to do that. We've always been very much dependent, and maybe dependent is the wrong word, but I see it in a sense as dependent on trade with the developed countries, aid from developed countries, etc. But I think we need both because we will always have to have trade. We are, highly open economies. We will always have to have trade with the advanced economies. But there is a lot more that we can do in this region as a region to secure the food and fuel security and independence that we need in this region. Of course, the crises, the last three crises that your country is facing, that this region is facing as it relates to climate change, then the pandemic, and then now this inflationary spiral. These crises have compounded each other to really drive that point home to us, that it's that much more important for us to have our own food and fuel security, and each of us cannot achieve it alone, but as a region, we can do much better. The reason I say we're getting a step closer to that is I'm not sure if you're aware, but we have a new Secretary General at CARICOM, and she's the first female Secretary General at CARICOM already. She has made some progress in this protocol where once three countries, which was recently passed, I think in February of this year, once three countries can agree on a particular initiative that they want to cooperate on, and the rest don't object, those three, that coalition of the willing, can go ahead and engage in that cooperation or integration initiative that they would like to. And this is something I think that can really unlock that level of regional integration and cooperation that we need. Because when those three get together, whoever they are, and do whatever it is that they plan to do, and the rest of the region sees it working, they're going to jump on board. And so sometimes you need a little bit of an initiative and impetus to get something moving, and then it snowballs. Perhaps that might be a way to get this region to be better coordinated. And I'm proud of the Secretary General for achieving that recently.
Okay, thank you. Do we have Mr. Urikem? Is Yuri there? No. We have there's a question here, which I guess we need to just throw out, and this may be to the minister. State-owned enterprises, what reforms the Davis administration will embark on so we can eventually offload them? Mr. Minister, could you take a stab at that?
Offload them, I suppose, meaning to privatize. I think the first step is to bring them to a point where they are not such a drain on the public purse. And state-owned enterprises, the BPL, the Water and Sewage Corporation, Bahamas Air, I think also the Broadcasting Corporation. There had been a commitment to reform of these state-owned enterprises, a long-standing issue. I think the first step is to begin. And within those have been many attempts. I recall, for example, BPL separation exercises, same with ZNS. But it seems as if, quite frankly, we're back at the same position that we were all those years ago. I think what needs to happen is, all of these entities have revenue raising capability. And so within those, we have to make sure that they are maximizing their revenue, they are controlling their costs, they are reducing their administration costs. And that is not done solely by, for example, reducing headcount, but they have to be made to run more, if not totally on a sort of for-profit basis, with a view that the strain on the amount of money that has to come from the central government is reduced. I mean, it might seem very basic, but I think that's a starting position, because if, for example, there is any time in the future any thought about any sort of privatization, they have to be first put in a position where someone would want to take them on. But I think as it stands now, with in the short term, no sort of privatization on the horizon, efforts just have to be made through the management with direction from the government that the operations have to be run in a way that they can, if not breaking even, at least minimize the amount of, or reduce the amount of money that comes from the government.
Definitely have to become efficient. It's my position that on those state-owned agencies, we need to start to reform them from the inside out, starting with the accountability and responsibility at the board level. Effective corporate governance, effective management, effective strategic management, I think is the way to go. We will go back to, so thank you very much, Mr. Minister. We'll go back to Ms. Turnquist or Mr. Urikem. Do you have another question directed for Ms. Dukaran?
Yes, I do. For Mr. Dugran, a question.
We haven't forgotten you, Gowan. We'll come back to you shortly.
Yes, so my question is concerning digital assets, our digital assets industry, particularly cryptocurrency. Mr. Dugran, what is your assessment? What is your thoughts on this? Is this a silver bullet? Are there any emerging concerns or risks? What can you say about our recent push?
Marla?
I think she had to drop.
Is she still with us? Well, why don't we lob that to Gowan? Is this a silver bullet? We have seen significant activity and optimism being expressed in this. So what would be your take on that?
I would say that it certainly is not a silver bullet. And the reason why I say that is that we have to respect and appreciate that the cryptocurrency industry or the digital asset space is actually an extension, or if you will, an expansion of investment opportunity. It has high volatility, it has attendant risks, and it has winners and losers. And I think that we have romanticized it to some extent because we have heard the stories of investing $1,000 and coming out a millionaire. And we've not focused enough attention on those who invested as a millionaire and came out as thousandaires, meaning that there is only a zero-sum game. That when we are talking about trading is having independent parties with their different professional opinions and judgments, making assumptions about the future and trading in relation to that. Now, to the point that I think you're raising, is it an opportunity to expand our financial services sector? Is it an opportunity to expand our economic output? The answer to that is yes, because when we see new businesses and new activities taking place, there's an opportunity because there's several factors. One, the taxes that they themselves will pay in terms of to the government coffers. So whether that's real property taxes, whether that's value added tax, whether that's business license fees or license fees to the regulators. Secondly, there's the employment opportunities. So they are going to employ persons in the environment in which they are. They will need their expertise and resources that they will necessarily bring with them, but there's an opportunity to develop a skill set. Thirdly, there is the, if you will, knock-on activity in terms of their consumption as we have more business activity. So I would summarize it by saying this, that when we see an expansion of industry into our country, it is a positive thing. When we see it as being able to multiply our earnings 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times, as being we can wipe out our debt because we just make a gamble on something that requires significant experience and significant expertise in order to do so, then the answer is no. So I would, if you will, harness your question to say, if we're looking at it to solve our woes, the answer is no. If we are looking to it to say that we have expanded economic activity in the country and so should be embraced, then the answer is yes.
Okay, solid. There is a
question. If I just add 30, one point to that is I agree with everything Gowan has said. And just to add that, you know, the whole crypto industry is very, very polarizing. There's some who swear by it, say this is the future, it's the best thing. And then there's some who want it to go away. Some of the big countries and those regulators and who are actually trying to make it go away. I agree it's not a silver bullet. But to the extent that we have attracted some operators in the space now, because of our regulation, we just need to make sure that we continue to modernize our regulation, that we build more capacity in terms of regulation. When I say build capacity, meaning, you know, those are more jobs for Bahamians in areas of compliance and regulation, et cetera. And we also build capacity in terms of operating the business. So tremendous opportunity there. I would treat it, as Gowan said, you know, when you're building a portfolio, you don't put all of your money in crypto. If you have a portfolio and you have some investments, you put a portion in it, understanding that it can be very volatile.
And I would align myself with your response, Minister, only that if you take a very careful read of the recent white paper on digital asset, you will see a line in it which says, digital asset, and I'm paraphrasing, digital asset is going to be critical in us recovering economically. How do you reconcile what you just said and that statement?
It's going to be critical because there is the, in my view, there is the, what I would call the asset, the coin, the, you know, all of those digital assets. And then there is the, so when you say it's going to be critical, there's also the technology that underlies it. And the cases, what they call, I think in IT, what they call the use cases.
Yeah, the use cases, yeah.
How do you actually deploy this technology? And so, you know, we go straight to the point of us being an archipelago, you know, and we're dispersed. And, you know, in terms of being able to do electronic payments and digital payments, and then using the technology to deliver education and to deliver healthcare and other government services throughout the island. So I think the broader statement is the whole idea of digitization and the technology that underlines it is going to be very critical for us. But also very critical will be, we believe that notwithstanding the recent gyrations and the fall off in the market, that you know, that this is going to be you know, a very, very important part of financial services going forward. And to the extent that for now we're recognized as one of the leaders in terms of people wanting to headquarter here, it's just incumbent upon us to maintain that lead by doing what we need to do to be on the cutting edge, and so people have no reason to leave.
And I think, Hubert, I'd actually take an even more direct view that financial services as it was, whether we like to admit it or not, has been contracting in the Bahamas. Mm-hmm. And so when we look at financial services, I think let's take, and I'm gonna use the word romanticize again, let's set that aside for a second and look back and appreciate that what made Wall Street, Wall Street? What made High Street the High Street in London? It was the players that congregated because there was an opportunity around the investing markets that were being developed. The reality is that when we look back even 20 years, when derivatives became, you know, very popular, and we were talking about swaps and we were talking about options and things of that nature, those were exotic. And even at the time, there were some who were very opposed to that and said that, you know, this is high stakes and very high risk. And the technology being one thing, but the technical experience, meaning that when you're bringing, you know, what I'm going to say, world-class lawyers, world-class accountants, world-class investors, world-class financial analysts, et cetera, because they are now excited about a particular new area, what is now exotic or what was exotic 20 years ago is now vanilla. So this is the new element of it. Now, if we look at it in terms of saying, is there an opportunity for the Bahamas to become the next High Street, the next Wall Street? It won't be with broker houses necessarily in terms of the Goldman Sachs and the like, who are with the traditional ones, but you have new exchanges that are emerging, which is in this space. And so to the point that the minister made, if we evolve having had a first mover advantage and we continue to ensure that it is regulated and the good players are kept and the bad players identified and extirpated, then the reality is we have an opportunity to have what is all of the ecosystem that surrounds it also migrate to the Bahamas, which is a tremendous opportunity. So I would separate, I think Minister is absolutely correct. Blockchain technology has infinite possibilities for an archipelagic nation. But equally, the industry, not the asset itself or the assets themselves, the industry creation has the opportunity for the Bahamas. And that's what we need to be looking at, not what I'm going to call the romantic side, which is saying, okay, all of these things went from pennies into $80,000, right? It is more, well, look at what the ecosystem developed around it, because there were all these players that wanted. We see 401ks in the UK, in the US now, saying it becomes a part of pension plans. We see investors in mutual funds that are now hedge funds that are now looking at how it becomes a part of a portfolio. We now see more engagement in it just because, yes, it is new. And like I said, I'm old enough to say, I remember when derivatives were exotic and now they are deemed to be vanilla products. And so this is just a new element that technology and innovation has allowed to emerge. And if we can harness it, then we should take advantage of it.
Look at them now. I'm certainly growing and developing. The maturation, I think, will bring value if we manage that effectively. There's a question here for you, Minister. There are questions about the government's ability to raise revenue as reported in the fiscal strategy report. Can you inform how the government intends to raise revenue in the upcoming budget? So we'll take that question from you, and then we will then go back over to Ava, who I think have a couple of other questions. So how does the government propose to raise revenue in this cycle?
First of all, the economy is growing. We're forecast to grow by 8% in 2022, and I think just over 4% in 2023. So we'll get part of the budget year would be, you know, we go from 1st of July 30th of June, so half in 2022, half in 2023, we will be in a growth, and we expect to be in a growth environment. So by virtue of the economy growing, our revenues will grow. That's one element of it. It's very, very important that we have, and we continue to fully staff up and equip what we call the Revenue Enhancement Unit. And that goes to what we call revenue administration and doing a better job of collecting what is due, not hounding the ordinary man on the street and shaking him down and making sure that those big taxpayers, those who can afford to pay, are adequately assessed and the taxes are collected. And even in cases where there needs to be, being able to have people who can, assist businesses in terms of payment plans, et cetera. So improving the revenue administration by having people in place whose job it is to make sure that the government's taxes are collected. And the third element of it, which is we might not see it in this cycle, but we're working very hard on the whole issue of carbon credits and being able to monetize them and to begin to see a revenue stream from them, hopefully within 18 months to 2 years. That is the timetable. But you will see the revenue generated by buoyancy because of the growth in the economy and because of what we're seeing in terms of what we have done in terms of revenue enhancement. In terms of when we talk about the economy growing, as the economy grows, more people are employed, they receive a paycheck, they spend money in the economy, money begins to circulate, they do things like build homes or consume services, and then some of that comes back to the government. So that is how we anticipated. We have a goal that we will get to 25% of revenue to GDP by 2024-25, and so we expect as we continue to strengthen, we'll achieve that goal.
Okay, I only need a one-word answer from you. Is this current budget going to create the trajectory to get us to that 25%, yes or no?
Yes.
Thank you very much, Minister. Ava Turnquest, over to you.
Okay, this question is for Minister Alkidis. What can we expect in terms of relief for Bahamians in this upcoming budget? Given the rising inflationary pressures, the one being gas, another being on groceries, without giving us the whole haul, just give us a bit of what can we expect.
I would say this. I'd answer it like this. And we know. I'll answer it like this. We recognize the tremendous pressure being put on individuals, on householders, on businesses. because of what's going on with inflation. We're not unsympathetic to it, as I've been accused of being, but there will be relief. But I would say, and as you said, and so I would just have to ask you to stay tuned, because as Governor said in his presentation, you know, our budget, I don't want to use, it's a bit of theater in that there's a lot of anticipation and there's a run-up and there's an unveiling. But I would say that we've been studying a lot of options, and so you can actually, you will see some relief in this budget. And so please, I can't say more because that's the Prime Minister's prerogative on this coming Wednesday the 25th, next week, less than a week.
But let me say something that I think is important, because we get into this element that I think is incorrect of government being a provider as opposed to a facilitator. And the question that persons raise, or the statements persons make, is what is government going to give to individuals to provide relief, as opposed to the initiatives that government is going to encourage in order to either bolster their income earning capacity or bring greater efficiency into the economy in terms of being able to withstand it. I think it's important that we don't shirk our responsibility as individuals to say that there was a reason that our forefathers or our older grandparents, great grandparents, and even some parents taught us about preparing for a rainy day. And Bahamians too often live a capitalistic lifestyle, wanting a social safety net, meaning that in times of buoyancy, that we ball it out. And then in times of difficulty, we said, what is the government going to do for us? We have to start instilling in our people that you have some responsibility in this, that you are adjusting your lifestyle in order to do so. So I don't take away, and the government has it as its initiatives and what it desires to do for the population. What I will say is this, that I think it's important that a program that was initiated several years ago that never got to fruition is important, and that's the RISE program, which was effectively a program that looked at, I'm going to say, a dignified manner of redistribution of taxes. Our system as it currently stands has a significantly unfair burden upon those who are least among us. And so we have to be mindful that we don't adjust the system trying to accommodate those who have least among us. We maximize the efficiency of the system to redirect any surpluses to those who need the support, whilst not giving breaks or concessions to those who are not in need of the support, but will invariably benefit from it if we take very broad brush approaches to relief. And so I think it is one of those aspects that, you know, as ministers say, stay tuned. Well, I will stay tuned, because I will say that, as they know, me being one of, the harshest critics, is I don't need my government to be a provider. I need my government to be a facilitator. And from that perspective, I wanted to say that, what am I responsible for? And if they show me my responsibility and show that they are equally responsible, then I understand that I have a role to play in it as well.
Important. So there's a question here from Dale Knowles. So, good day all. Considering a lower tax rate on a 2x increase in revenue has a favorable net impact than a multi-point increased tax rate across the board. I think basically saying that if you reduce the rate, you could have more favorable, or at least revenue positive outcome. So referencing this new budget, Mr. Minister, will it include an attitude of abundance empowered by the focus on innovation for new revenue and not just management of costs? I know you can't tell us everything, but what is the attitude here?
You cannot get by strictly on management of costs, because frankly, what happened within our framework, maybe 80%. Of the budget is fixed with salaries, debt service, other fixed commitments of the government. So the government, when it comes to saving costs, it's not going to do it. We have to grow the economy, and I've said before, we have to leap out of that that negative 0.1%, 1%, 0.5%. that we have been, that cycle we've been in for so many years. We have to leap out of that. And my belief is that a big part of it is that we have to move to the point where we are, for example, in terms of infrastructural development, where we can target that development more so that it creates economic activity. It won't create a return in terms of generating revenue directly to the government, but we have to be able to be in a position to say, okay, this is the ideal place to put a new airport, or this place needs to be prioritized in terms of improving the docking facility, for example, because that would spur some activity, and that would generate growth, and eventually something comes back into the government coffers. So perhaps even more creatively deploying your capital budget. But we have to move that. Unfortunately, you know, traditionally, and we're all being very frank on this webinar, some things have happened because, you know, constituencies need to be developed, and where there's pressure, it goes there. And of course, Bahamians, they need the infrastructure. But I think eventually what we need to do is move more towards, yes, we recognize that every citizen is equal and deserves, you know, services on a equal level, but let's start prioritizing and putting to the front of the line projects that can generate, that can spur activity, so that, you know, if you put in this airport, then that will bring things alive. And so you have to, that's a long answer to say, you can't strictly depend on trying to pinch the pennies, because what's going to happen is if you try to pinch it, if you get a hurricane, you have to spend the money. If you have some other event, what the economists call it, some externality, something happens outside of your control, you have to spend the money. Mm-hmm. And so just trying to, so you have to constantly be pursuing ways to grow the economy, expand the economy. For example, we have to promote, you know, development in the Family Islands. There's an attitude shift for people who now, let's say people who visit, they want to go to a smaller place. They don't, perhaps not everybody wants to go to the mega resort. They want to have a different experience. And so we have to find ways to incentivize people to get into that part of the industry. And by spreading it out, we actually strengthen our economy. So long story short, now controlling the expense won't do it alone. You have to always be pursuing growth in your economy.
I think that is important, because the growth, as going back to what Gowan said, when you create the growth, when you create a surplus and the excess, then you're better able to supplement the social systems, and that is important. Gowan, I want to come back to you, and I think within the context of the Bahamas' current financial challenges, the debt situation is our Achilles heel. And you made a point earlier that the budget doesn't belong to the government, it belongs to the people. Within the context of a 53 to 47% debt mix, external to domestic being the larger portion, is there a role for business houses, for banks, for local entities who have the wherewithal to start to step back and say, do we have a role here in helping the government to release some pressure, to pull some trigger, so that we can have a reorientation of the balance of the portfolio and therefore give the government greater room? I.e., we have seen in the past where there seemed to be a reluctance of persons taking up more of the domestic debt. Is there a role for the business sector in this process, which ultimately helps the country and then helps the business sector? Talk to us about it.
There's a mouthful in it, and I think there certainly is a role for the private sector in it. But I think there's some very fundamental elements that we have to appreciate, that actually up until this point, government debt was by and large the largest consumer of capital in the country, right? There simply was not alternative investments in which to put money into. And so we often turn to the private sector and say, well, why is it that there's a dialing back? Well, there's a prudence and fiscal responsibility even on businesses, that if your pension plans, if your surplus reserves and treasury management has already invested in a significant amount of government debt security, then expanding it is actually saying you have to breach what is, you know, advisable to you in diversity and diversify in a portfolio in order to become significantly overweighted. Now, with that being said, there is a tremendous amount of excess liquidity in our system, and we need to work with government in terms to build the confidence with it so that persons who have not yet invested that level into their portfolios and put it into securities start to do more of that with it. Now, what do I mean by that? There are some very wealthy traditional persons who remember the time when bank deposits used to pay 8%, 7%, and they are still fixated on term deposit and savings accounts being the savings mechanism for building wealth, when in reality, there's a greater opportunity for them now to actually have a diversified portfolio and say, well, you can take 20% of that, 25% of that, and start to put into government securities, which will actually give you a better return than are sitting on bank deposits. It is with not an extended risk, because I'm going to come back to that one, meaning people see it that the bank is safer than the government, right? And that perception, whether it's reality or not, is a significant driving force. And we need to change that mindset to say that government is effectively to be seen traditionally as the risk-free or the lowest risk within an economy. And there's a very simple reason. Government has the ability to tax everyone else in order to meet its obligations. So if it runs into a very severe circumstance, government has an ability that is actually unique to it in an economy, meaning that it is a monopoly and it has an ability to take and extract more. So I think it goes down to how does the private sector collectively with government say that those that may have already have a significant weighting, what is the confidence as to why you have that weighting and are not necessarily reducing it? How do you then encourage others to create a similar weighting? But I will say this, and this is important, that the fear, or there should not be fear of foreign currency debt, as long as we have a balance of payment strategy and foreign currency strategy that says that when we borrow in foreign currency, we have to be creating industry that generates foreign currency revenues in order to build the capacity to repay it. And put in very simple terms, if I borrow $1 million in US, and the US market is much larger, I have to be able to demonstrate that I can earn $1 million plus in US in order to repay it. So it is not as simple. Now, the government, in reality, when the government looks at it and says, on the face of it, we may say, well, all government revenues is earned in Bahamian dollars. But the reality is that's not true. The government actually earns visitor taxes. The government earns port fees. The government earns fees from its airspace and others. Those are in foreign currency. And so we need to do a better job of government in terms of saying, when we look at our 2 billion, hopefully, and 2.2 billion in revenue, that how much of that is foreign currency, meaning US dollars, that will allow us to start to repay it. So I know it's a difficult one to, I'm going to say, answer in its fullness in this time, but the answer is that there has to be a collaborative effort to say, how do we build confidence? Meaning all stakeholders have to work. Meaning government can't do things that people see as stupid in terms of the money that they're using. Those who have investment in government have to say why their analysis says there is confidence. And those who do not have investment in government are open to listening to say that I am not simply avoiding it because I have paranoia versus what I'm going to call educated investment strategy.
Okay, and I think that's useful.
Let me chime in right there, please, if I may, Mr. Edwards.
I'm going to give you a chance to chime in on this, Minister. But as you chime in, just taking from what Gowan said, And piggybacking on the question we had before about speaking with the international investors and the international market, isn't this indicative of some level of need on the part of the government to have a better conversation with the domestic players?
Well, absolutely. And we have had that conversation. We had one earlier this year. And at that, when we wrapped that up, we agreed to have one immediately following the presentation of the budget, so that they can have, they can have access to more information, and we can have a more sort of fulfilling discussion. But the point is well taken. So we're doing that conversation with the banks, the local banks, and the investing community, banks and investing community together. And as Gowan said, there are individuals who have significant assets. As a matter of fact, we are engaging them just this week, as a matter of fact, and we are exploring some opportunities whereby we can be able to have the individual who doesn't have the eight figures or those figures, but who has, a few thousand dollars maybe, and they're getting zero in the bank. We're working right now. I can say we're working with the central bank to come up with a position where they can be able to invest in something and get more than zero. So the point is very well taken. Everything Gowan says is well taken. I take the view that we have to build that confidence, and we build it with the international community by talking to them, and we have to as well build it with our local community. Yeah.
Definitely.
And the final point is the point Gowan made about the being able to match your foreign exchange earnings and to be able to justify foreign exchange borrowing. We have, and we are building out our debt management unit here at the Ministry of Finance. And so that as we build capacity, we'll be able to do more of that, have individuals who can do more of that analysis and more of that matching. So. And that's something we have on the horizon.
Okay, thank you so much. We have a couple of comments in there. I'll share these one quickly. I don't think there's anything wrong with a social net system. We like to think of government as a neoliberalist way. The government can be an active agent to improve the lives of the citizen. And I assure you that there are a broad number of Bahamians that are in need of government assistance. Cases of Lula da Silva and Brazil are good cases where populations have been lifted out of poverty through government assistance programs. So that's a comment which came from one individual. Is the government considering implementing a payroll tax for middle and high income wage earners, that is earners above 52,000, Mr. Minister?
No.
Okay. The answer to that is no. Another question here for you. Will the budget address or give consideration to the impact of cooperatives, credit unions in particular, or the family island with the exit of commercial banks?
A few years ago we moved because cooperatives and the credit unions had gotten so large that we moved the administrative regulation of them to the central bank. I'm sure there's a role that the cooperatives can play in the absence of the banks. But we are looking at some other solutions in terms of agency banking and using technology. Also, the central bank will be increasing and upping their PR and their rollout of the sand dollar that had a bit of a pause because of COVID. So I'm sure we'll be looking at how and we welcome that conversation with the cooperatives on how they can assist. But we are looking at being able to digitize, for example, the operations of the post office savings bank, which is in every island, and how we can use you know, agency banking, where you don't have to have a physical bank, but you can have a space in another building and be able to have banking services. And so again, that comes back to digitization and being able to roll that out. But I'm sure we can have that, now that it's been raised, we'll have that conversation on how we can incorporate cooperatives and bring them into the conversation as well.
I think it's a critical question before I come to you, Gowan, because I personally have a concern for cooperatives and credit union. There seem to be a significant reduction and curtailment in the amounts which are out there operating effectively. And when we consider the impact or the relationship that cooperatives and credit union have, especially with segment of the vulnerable population, persons who need to raise capital to start a business, I think that some sort of a special attention should be placed there, you know, Minister. So as you go through your deliberation, I think this is an area which would be useful for additional discussion.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I made a note of it. I know one of the concerns when the regulation was migrated to the central bank was would the smaller cooperatives fall through the cracks and sort of, you know, be out of sight, out of mind. But so now that the point is raised and you reinforced it, that is something we'd look at. And the struggles you're having and what's causing the lack of use, et cetera.
Yes. To you, Gowan, I think this individual asks a question. I know the answer, but I'll leave it to you. Does this prospectus that you speak of exist? If yes, where can it be found? And if not, when can we expect that it is to be done? Now, the last part must be for the minister, but you can fill in the blanks for the rest.
So you just answered it because you're saying the last part is for the minister. So it means, you know, the answer is it's not formulated in a manner that is useful in the international community, meaning that we see there is information about the government's financial affairs. So we have budgets, we have the level of debt stock, we have information in the central bank. So we have, I'm going to say, information pieces that are maintained by the central bank as the registrar transfer agent for BGRS, BGS, treasury bills and others. We have some information in the budget that looks at the total debt that exists for government. But in terms of the prospectus that I'm speaking about, no, I have never seen it. And it is one that I think is critical for us to formulate. I'll leave the minister to answer the question in terms of, because he answered by saying that the debt management unit is being expanded internally. And so analysis and the ability to formulate information. But I just want to address two elements that were earlier stated. And one of them is, I know the minister has what I'm going to call his collective responsibility. And so from that perspective, there are the elements that are being deliberated. I think that we have reached a point in time where when people are asking the question, will there be tax reform, that as opposed to us stating that there's not going to be new taxes, that our answer is, we are going to analyze and empirically study and make the best decision for the country going forward. The reason why I say that is, with VAT introduction, if people remember, it was absolutely not, it was opposition, that then moved to, okay, well, let us understand what the studies and empirical analysis says, to, it is not what we would like, but we think it is going to be better based on the empirical analysis that has been performed, to, we accept it, but there needs to be some, some parameters that are agreed upon, to then eventually the private sector actually working with government to roll it out. I say that to say that persons look at taxes saying, and I'll use this term that the minister used, new taxes. If we reform a system, that means that we actually, what I'm going to say, start with a blank sheet of paper. It's not as simple as that, but meaning a blank sheet of paper, and say that the new tax system that we are going to roll out may involve new taxes that will effectively replace the inefficient and ineffective tax system that we have, or components of tax, so that when the individual is thinking about tax reform, they're not seeing it solely as just hiking up my tax bill. And I say that because when we look at where our tax to GDP number is being less than 20%, and the government having stated a commitment to work it to 25%, that number was not picked out of thin air. That number is a number that has been demonstrated as being useful in developed countries in terms of being able to provide services. So, you know, so the reality is that was benchmarked. But the reality is, may that mean that we have to reform the tax system such that the equity that was spoken about earlier means that there's greater ability to extract taxes from those who have the capacity to pay, and a reduction in the tax burden has to be borne by persons. And that may very well be a income-based tax system that is able to be rolled out. But I think most important is saying, we have to not dismiss tax reform as being additional tax. And I would only say with the minister, and he knows that I say this to him all the time, don't say that there's not going to be new taxes. Say that we are not going to increase the tax burden on individuals, but we may very well have a new system of taxes that comes about.
Yes, and that's good advice, because Mr. Minister, we don't believe it often. We know why you're saying it and how you're saying it, but generally speaking, for those persons who follow this thing, they anticipate that there must be changes. Let me ask you a very quick question before I go to my main question for you, Mr. Minister. The question here from Tate Adley. Should we be confident in the government's ability to curb the effects of volatility and scamming within the crypto industry? What would be your take on that?
We have what we think is a very, that is world-class regulation. We amended it today in the Senate, amended it yesterday in the House of Assembly. The view is amongst the regulator to continue to build their capacity to be on the cutting edge, to engage the professionals that they need to. So I suppose you'd never get to zero, but you want to demonstrate to the scammers and the other name that was used that this is a jurisdiction that has a robust regulation, and so there's no room for them. It's not the wild, wild west, so to speak. You might always get one or two bad actors, but the idea is to be able to identify them and get rid of them quickly.
My next question, therefore, to you is, what will make the Bahamas as a country economically grow at this point in time and into the future? Right now, we see that based on all the projections mm-hmm. from various institutions and really from our own calculation, it seems mm-hmm. as if after we get this bounce from the growback, from the mm-hmm. downturn, we get to 8% or 6%, there seems to be in the midterm a reversion to that 2% mm-hmm. growth. Mm-hmm. The IMF that we should maybe be at about 4% in order to achieve the things that we're achieving. What is going to cause this to happen? Where do you see the growth industries in the Bahamas?
I think one of the main things that we have to tackle is the cost of electricity. Right? I think that is a significant burden on business and individuals. And so we have to, accelerate that transition to the less costly fuel and then to greener fuel. I think that what we have to do, I mean, you have some economists who are saying that, they're looking at what's happening with the stock market, and they're saying the U.S. might be one element that pushes the U.S. into recession. I think based on our proximity and the fact that that's a main trading partner, we can still have a healthy economy in terms of visitors coming, people coming to invest, and so what we have to do is we just have to continue to beat the drums for development, bringing in foreign investment, and making sure that it's easy for Bahamians to get into business. So I think the main thing, we have to tackle that cost of electricity. make government services easier, remove some of the roadblocks. You know, we're moving full speed ahead with the digitization project, which should make things, continue to make things easier. And I think if we do that, and we can maximize, you know, our position in terms of the tourism sector, maximize what's happening in financial services with this new development, I think we can you know, escape that low growth path. I think what is happening, I'm hopeful that you know, being battered by Dorian and then, you know, clobbered by COVID-19, is that you know, there's a greater sense of urgency to make the changes. One example, it might be a small example, but you notice a lot of people, you know, starting to do their backyard gardening and their their small cottage industry, maybe a side business, because there's a realization that you know, in the midst of peace and safety is sudden destruction. And you know, Gowan was quoting songs earlier, but I'm saying there's a greater sense of urgency. So I believe that if we have new initiatives that are well thought out, that we can communicate to people, that there'll be acceptance of it. And one of them is going to be this accelerated move towards you know, cheaper fuel and renewable, and then on to renewable energy.
Definitely, I think. Energy is a ubiquitous one. It touches everything within the economy. Mm-hmm. But I also believe, Mr. Minister, more energy needs to be placed in this idea of using our greatest asset. And as it stands right now, the greatest thing that we have going for us is tourism. And the question is not only how we can diversify, but how we can glean, or as I like to put it, domesticate more of the revenue from tourism, which then creates a knock-on effect which benefits the country. And so while we have heard about greater linkages with agriculture and so on and so forth, I think we are at the place where we need to get a little bit more serious about domesticating those revenue.
I don't disagree. And I actually think that what we need to do, and I've been speaking to my colleagues, is we've seen some things happening. For example, we know that Disney is in South Eleuther. We know that the ground has been broken for the port in Freeport, in Grand Bahama. We know that there's a MOU for the sale of the Grand Lucayan. And so what we need to do now is to not sit back and hope that the Bahamian citizens see these and say, oh, there's an opportunity there, but use the agencies of government to go into those places and say, look, this is what's happening. Here are some potential opportunities. And who's ever interested, here's how much the government can do in terms of either through its agencies assisting with financing, or maybe as far as encouraging the private sector to do some finance. So we have to play a more active role. And I say again that we have no choice, because we have to, you know, we're up at 80 some, you know, maybe mid 80s debt to GDP. We have a hurricane season coming up. We don't know what's happening with COVID. So when we speak about the runway, we have to recognize that, you know, perhaps it's not so long. We have to get busy, like you say.
Yeah, we have to get busy. Yeah. We're kind of running out of time in terms of...
Sorry.
No problem.
This has been a very, very good conversation. You want to make a comment?
Yeah, just with that one, and I think, and it goes back to something Happy said as well, right? We have to have the private sector put its money where its mouth is. And by that, I mean that it is always said, well, if government gives the right concessions, then business will grow. The reality is businesses need to put a proposition to government that says, if you provide me this concession, this is the revenue stream that I can create, and therefore this multiple will take place. Not a hope and a prayer. A concrete plan that says, and this is what I'm standing behind. Now, I'm not saying it is an absolute guarantee, meaning that that's what private sector has to do. So that's one thing. The second thing is, to something you said that I actually interpret slightly different. And when we say domesticate, for me, it is about saying, how do we get greater domestic ownership in what is deemed to be international revenue generating activity? Meaning that how do we formulate our economic policy that is not around the, what I'm going to call how do we get gifted as citizens, meaning that we have a foreign direct investor who puts an establishment and then provides employment. But rather, when we have a project, how do we match Bahamian capital with foreign projects to say that we now have an actual part-owned multinational operation that is then going to lead to several benefits. One, the profits will now stay local because the individuals own it, and then the foreign currency. So, and then finally, I'll just say the land policy, something the minister spoke on, that I am one that, as a very keen observer of our fiscal affairs, will say this, that I don't like when we seem to give freehold land into any project. And I think that we don't need to do so. And I think we can do a far greater service to ourselves by ensuring that we have a proper land policy that says you can have a very long-term lease, but in the event of any event, it doesn't have land being held in ownership of a foreign entity that doesn't use it. And one thing I'll throw to the minister, and I'll play as your moderator, because you skipped over the comment and the question, and it was a cruel based accounting, and I know you're wrapping up. So I would just say to the minister, the question was it a pipe dream? And my thing is, certainly the profession that I represent will say that they are ready and able to stand to do so. But I will say, accrual-based account is not only on the liability side, it is also recognizing the asset. And if we understand what we own, we may actually present a stronger picture. And that's the only question to the minister. He was able to answer all of them very short. So that one, are we going to see accrual-based accounting in his political term?
One word answer, Mr. Minister.
Hopefully.
Thank you so much. I want to remind you that we are actually broadcasting on radio, so we have to stay on time. We have about 3 minutes. I have a quick question here for you, Mr. Minister Bianca Butler from Facebook at, is there going to be an increase in minimum wage in order to increase taxes, increase in minimum wage?
I couldn't say if it will happen in this budget or if it will be announced next week, Wednesday. But okay. I know that it is a commitment of the government to work with the Tripartite Council to increase the minimum wage.
Thank you. Yeah, and just want to give due respect to our question persons who are asking question. We continue to propose new housing construction in New Providence, which is depleting green space. There are many houses for sale, whether through distress or abandonment. Can government consider incentive to promote purchasing built homes, thereby preserving green space in New Providence, as well as rehabilitating communities?
Yes, there's a move to decrease some more the import duties on building materials, and as well there are incentives for first-time homeowners that do not attach strictly to the purchase. But I agree with the question. As as we move further out to the outskirts, we seem to abandon the central part of the island where there's infrastructure already in place, et cetera. So that's something to be pursued, yes.
And I'll add on to it by saying that we have a significant inventory of distressed properties. And so one thing that is critical for government to have an appreciation of is that the stability of the economy is one that having unproductive assets has a drag. And so when you have homes that have been pledged under mortgages that are in distress, it is far better to have an effort to get those into productive hands so that you free up capital, because the financial institutions who are now holding bad loans that are secured by these will have some cash flows coming in and can redirect them.
Definitely. And so we're clean out of time. I think this was a wonderful conversation. I will give you about 30 minutes. Go on to wrap up. I know you can't do it in 30 minutes, but I'm going to try.
Exactly. If you say 30 minutes, I could do it in 30 minutes.
Yeah, 30 seconds.
I end by simply saying a goal without a plan is just a wish. And so I want to see us use the budget and its auxiliary documents like the fiscal strategy report, the quarterly reporting and information to now demonstrate that we actually do have a plan that is not, if you will, annual or political cycle, but is multi-generational. And if we do that, I think the country will be in a far better place.
Thank you so much. You have broken your own record, Mr. Gowan Bow. It was certainly a pleasure having you, always a pleasure having this discussion with you. Mr. Minister, as you wrap up, help us to understand and convince us that you, as an administration, understand the need to lengthen the runway, not because of who is coming behind you, but because we are doing this for our country.
Definitely, and I speak of it often, the work that we do is for, not so much for us, but for the generations that follow. I want to thank you for this opportunity. I think it's important to have these sorts of conversations. I want to reiterate, this administration is committed to the information sharing, to all of the reporting, to trying to get them out in a timely manner, and having them examined and having this sort of exchange, because it keeps us accountable. In one word, in terms of the prospectus, that requires us to have a level of consensus, and I'm hopeful that in the ensuing months, we can coalesce around a consensus that this is what we need to do to lengthen that runway, and so that in politics, it's always you propose and oppose, but hopefully we can coalesce around some common objectives. Because we really need to rebuild that headroom and get on a better financial footing. And I think we do that by having these sorts of discussions and promoting a more collegial discussion instead of always the confrontational kind in the political sphere. But thank you very much. It's been a great pleasure, and I really appreciate you inviting me.
Yeah, thank you so much for accepting to be here. This is the first of ORG's roundtable, and there will be others. And we want to be able to promote the idea that we can come together, even when we disagree, and we can have the conversation, because the conversations that we are having, the conversations that we are promoting, is going through one filter and one filter only. What is in the best interest of the Bahamas? And as long as we do that, we automatically are on the same side, and therefore we should be having the discussion in the direction of becoming better. We have heard here tonight exactly how some things are being done, some great things are being done, and how they need to be built out. There's certainly headwinds and there's certainly challenges. But as we anticipate the upcoming budget, we want to look and we want to carefully analyze and assess, based on the things that we have heard here tonight, how well this will serve us going into the future. So you have been listening to, this has been the ORG's Roundtable, and you've also been listening to The Essentials on Guardian Radio. And so we want to say to you, thank you for taking time out to be with us. We look forward to continuing our conversation, and we ask you to go out and do the one thing which has been said over and repeatedly here tonight. Remember, this budget belongs to all of us. So let's go out and do the things which need to be done as citizens and residents, in order for us to advance the cause of the Bahamas. Good night, good evening, good morning, wherever you are, and we look forward to continuing the conversation. Thank you.
This has been a special episode of The Essentials with Hubert Edwards. Tonight, Hubert was joined by Minister of Economic Affairs, Senator Michael Arquitas, Gawain Bo, CEO of Fidelity Group, and Maladou Karen, renowned Caribbean economist for ORG's Economic Roundtable. Thank you for tuning in.